From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. One of Donald Trump's key selling points as a candidate was his track record for making business deals. An NC State University expert looks into how that skill translates into Trump's work in the White House. North Carolina's senior U.S. senator has a front-row seat for Russian efforts to disrupt American society. He shared what he knows about Russian misdeeds during a recent speech at Duke. The State House has unveiled its budget plan. You'll learn key details. Some state lawmakers want to make $400 available for every public school teacher. The money would pay for classroom supplies. You'll learn why. And speaking of education, Donna Martinez joins us with more on that topic. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
Union-backed education activists for the second year left their North Carolina classrooms and headed to Raleigh for the May 1st protest and rally. Now, the group said that education is in crisis in North Carolina and that something must be done. Their something turned out to be a $6 billion list of demands. Now, our next guest, Dr. Terry Stoops of the John Locke Foundation, says that the activists are correct. North Carolina does have an education crisis, but he points out that the activists have failed to recognize exactly what that crisis is. He says it's with student achievement. Dr. Stoops joins us now to talk about that. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
This is the second year that we've seen thousands of people come to Raleigh to protest and rally. You were there. What was your impression?
Well, the crowd seemed to be smaller than they were last year, and that was the initial thought was that as many as 50,000 would show up, and that's what some people were saying in advance of the march, that there would be that many. But it really didn't turn out to be that many. I would say that probably wasn't more than 5,000 there in attendance, which is still, I think, fairly impressive, but definitely not more than showed up last year. And there seemed to be some really strong political overtones to a lot of the speakers, and certainly the list of demands that were released by the North Carolina Association of Educators before the march. So there seemed to be a lot of stronger political overtones than there were last year, and I think their list of demands is a good evidence of that.
Let's talk about that list. It included a number of demands for additional pay, additional resources, even the expansion of Medicaid in North Carolina, leaving some folks, including you, kind of wondering, when it comes to Medicaid, for example, how that relates to children whatsoever. But what did you make of the list of $6 billion plus that they're demanding?
Yeah, I summed it up as more money, more manpower, and more Medicaid. And there were some things on here that, they might have found some common ground with Republican legislators. For example, having more school psychologists and school social workers, I think, is a concern by many Republicans looking at maybe some mental health assistance that schools could need. But a lot of these proposals don't have strong support by Republicans and were dead on arrival. Medicaid expansion is a good example of that. And it's hard to imagine how Medicaid expansion would help kids, because going into this, there were a lot of people, a lot of teachers saying, oh, we need Medicaid expansion because they're going to be help kids or help the kids' parents. But the Medicaid expansion population, between 78 and 82% of that expansion population are childless adults. These are neither children nor people that have children. So it's hard to imagine that there would be any direct relationship between Medicaid expansion and being able to help children directly in the classroom. And then there were other things on the list of demands, such as increasing cost of living adjustment for retirees that would have enormous consequences, not only for the budget this year, but in budgets in the future, because that alone would add a $2.5 billion unfunded liability to our retirement system. So there were, I thought, many things on this list of demands that really weren't well thought out. And it really wasn't, in the end, designed to try to find some common ground with Republican legislators. It was, just like the march itself, a political maneuver.
Terry, you wrote in several different pieces coming up to this rally that you agreed essentially that there is a crisis in public education in North Carolina. But you have said, look, we need to be aware of what's happening with student achievement and, in some cases, the lack of student achievement. And you were kind of scratching your head saying, look, people would be willing to work together with the activists who were protesting, along with others who have a different point of view, around that common goal of trying to lift kids up.
First, it was striking to me that there were so few mentions about student achievement through this entire process leading up to the march, during the march, after the march. But the reality is in the numbers of student achievement numbers that we get from the state every year. And last year, barely half of the elementary and middle school students in North Carolina are proficient in math and reading. That's really the central issue here, is that thousands, even millions of students are not proficient in math and reading. And when you look at student subgroups, because that includes everyone, but when you look at African-American children, when you look at Hispanic children, and especially African-American males, which have some of the lowest levels of achievement in North Carolina, it's even lower than half. So less than half of students in those subcategories are proficient in math and reading. That should be everyone's concern. That should be our focus as a state, rather than looking at ways to just throw more money at the districts. We should be looking at ways to strategically use the money that's allocated to increase student achievement.
Terry, the numbers that you have cited are truly alarming. I mean, when you think about what that portends for those girls and boys who aren't achieving now, what does that mean for them 4 years from now, 10 years from now, when they're adults trying to make their way in the world and support themselves, have a family, lead a productive, happy life? What does that mean if we don't address this?
Well, it means we're losing a generation, frankly. And this is the really sad part, is that look beyond the numbers of students that would go to get higher education and think about the fact that those that are graduating don't have the basic skills to be successful in the workforce at entry-level jobs, especially these low-income kids, minority kids in counties that don't have a whole lot of opportunities. They are graduating facing few job opportunities, virtually no opportunity to get higher education or any sort of post-secondary training. This is a lost generation, and that should be everyone's concern. And I hadn't heard one mention of that through all the speakers, from Mark Jewell, the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, to Reverend William Barber, the Poor People's Campaign. I hadn't heard one mention of student achievement through all those discussions and all those speeches during the rally.
One of the curiosities about the day that was chosen for this rally, a Wednesday midweek, a teaching day, was that there were counties in North Carolina where kids had been out of school because of storms, hurricanes, several different counties particularly devastated by that. And you wrote that people should be concerned about losing an instruction day and that that is consequential. People may not realize how consequential that is. Help us understand.
Well, first of all, it's important to look at the calendar itself and to realize that a lot of these school districts had spring break the week before the march. So you had kids out of school for a week. They came back for a couple days, and then they were off again. And then they came back to school for two other days that probably weren't as productive as they needed to be. Every day is important for student achievement, and every day needs to be better than the day before. And unfortunately, there were those that participated in the march that called off that day under the idea that, oh, it's just one day. And it shouldn't be just thought of as one day. Every day is important, and especially during the instructional year as testing comes up and as students come back from spring break. It was a critical day, and the teachers should have found another day to have their make their voices heard.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of Donald Trump's selling points as a presidential candidate was his business experience, especially his skill at making deals. He had written a 1987 bestseller called The Art of the Deal. How has Trump's business savvy translated into the political arena? Our next guest discussed that topic recently with the John Locke Foundation. Andrew Taylor is a political scientist at North Carolina State University, also a columnist for Carolina Journal. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So I just mentioned Art of the Deal was, before he became president, one of the things that Donald Trump was best known for. You were interested in looking at how the ideas presented in that book translate into Donald Trump as president.
Yeah. Yeah. And political scientists don't read it. I think that, you know, they look down their noses at, obviously a lot of them look down their noses at anything Trump, but particularly this, because they presumably don't think it's relevant to understanding what he would be like as president. But the book, it was a very important book, American business literature. It was a bestseller for a year in the 1980s. It transformed Trump from into a national and international personality and business icon. And it contains in it a lot of stuff that's not really relevant to the idea of presidential leadership. But there are a few strategies in there in how to make a deal that I thought, wow, this is really interesting and could be applied to him being president and thinking about presidential leadership as a deal that you have to make with a variety of different kinds of people. Some people who are kind of like you and want to be partners, like, for example, the Congressional Republican leadership. Other people who may be adversaries, like Congressional Democrats or like certain foreign leaders. So I really thought this would be an interesting exercise to look at those strategies and try to see how they've played out while Trump has been president.
What are some of the things that you saw in The Art of the Deal as you were reading it and said, oh, yes, this really does have a definite way to apply it to the presidential style?
Well, there's in chapter two, there's 11 winning strategies, Trump calls them. And some of them, as I said in answer to the last question, aren't particularly relevant to presidential leadership. But I picked out, and possibly arbitrarily, but they seem to present themselves to me as relevant to presidential leadership. So things such as being able to use leverage to pressure the person that you're dealing with, to use a wide variety of different strategies, to be unpredictable, to try to put your opponent off because you've done something that wasn't expected, to think big, to moonshot or hit a home run rather than play small ball, to use a sporting metaphor. There were five of these strategies that I was able to glean from those 11 that I wanted to use and apply to Trump as president.
We are chatting with Andrew Taylor, political scientist at North Carolina State University. One of the things that you also did after looking at the book was say, okay, well, how does this play out in the types of things that President Trump has actually had to do? And you looked at the normal lawmaking process, also the budget process, and his dealings with foreign leaders, and found some very different things.
Yeah, so there are, I thought, three different types of deal-making scenarios that presidents are put into. One's making laws, regular legislative process in which you deal with Congress. And there, the interesting thing is if there's no deal, nothing really happens. The status quo continues. The second process was the budget, which is very interesting because the budget isn't a regular piece of legislation because, as we all know, and we've lived through one of these very recently, if budget bills aren't passed, if spending bills aren't passed, the government shuts down, which is a way in which that you can place additional pressure on the participants in the deal. And I thought, well, on budgets, that should help Trump. The way he likes to make deals, according to the art of the deal, the way he likes the negotiating strategies he uses, the budget making process should be amenable to, more amenable to his strategies than the regular lawmaking process. And then, as you said, Mitch, there's the third one, which is dealing with foreign leaders. And there should, and I argue that should be most likely to be Trump for, to be successful, most consistent with his winning strategies as explained in Art of the Deal, because he can really sort of be unpredictable. What is the outcome of no deal? We don't know. The president can pull things out of his back pocket. He can make threats. He can make feints. He can be unpredictable in a way that you cannot be if you're president in the domestic arena in dealing with the Congress. And so I sort of hypothesized that scenario number three would be much better, much more suited to Trump's winning strategies.
Looking at those strategies and what we have seen for presidents in the recent past, are these very different ways than we are accustomed to seeing our president operate?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this has to do, obviously, with Trump's background. He is unique, really, amongst our modern presidents. The only president with a background that is remotely like his, completely outside of politics, in the post-war period is Eisenhower. And of course, Eisenhower and Trump are very different people and have had very different kinds of experiences. So coming out of the business world, he's obviously going to approach the presidency and presidential leadership in a very different way than anybody that we can think of. He hasn't been trained in the way that George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush have been trained, or even a Barack Obama, who didn't have a particularly lengthy political resume, but was much more of a conventional politician than Donald Trump was.
Do we have a sense of how people are responding to this style? Do we know yet whether people say, you know, I kind of like having a president who acts this way, or are people saying, let's go back to what we had before?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people's views of Trump, of course, are colored not by that. They don't sort of sit down and assess Trump and say, you know what, I don't really like him, but that was a pretty smart move he pulled. Or I do like him, but he really kind of messed up strategically there. Their views of Trump are so polarized, the vast majority of the public, that they don't even visit this issue intellectually. They don't even contemplate it. We might be helped in the future when we can look back sort of more objectively and analyze Trump and be able to pull back some of the layers and be able to evaluate him that way. But no, people just don't do that. This is such a heavily polarized environment that people don't seem to be in a position to be able to evaluate President Trump that way.
In the brief time that we have left, for those who have to negotiate with Donald Trump, would they be well served reading Art of the Deal and trying to glean some of what they might get from the other side of that negotiation?
Possibly. I mean, I think the art of Trump's presidential deal is very similar to the art of the deal and his winning 11 winning strategies that he talked about in the book. So you can see we've got 2 years of Trump presidency now. I think that tells you as much as the book did. And to that extent, I feel pleased with the project, because that's the whole goal, isn't it? And reason why I think Art of the Deal is important, because it does instruct a lot of what this presidency has been like. So they don't have to read the book, but they certainly have to study Donald Trump.
Andrew Taylor, political scientist at North Carolina State University and also a columnist for Carolina Journal. Thanks so much for joining us. And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's senior U.S. Senator leads the Senate's Intelligence Committee. In that role, Richard Burr sees the negative impact Russia has had on American society in recent years. He recently discussed the issue with a Duke University audience.
Russia extensively played in 2016, not necessarily in the election. What Russia did was they tried to create societal chaos running up to an election. Russia used less than $100,000 to attack the American society. The thing that we need to get through the media skulls and to the American people is this really wasn't about an election. This was about a 1960s Soviet mentality that if it's bad for America, it's good for them. And they used 21st century tools to do it. And they used our own First Amendment protection to hide behind.
So is Russia America's number one foreign policy threat today?
Russia is a huge concern. On any given day, North Korea might be in front of that. On any given day, Iran might be in front of that. Any given day, China might be in front of that. But from a standpoint of a relentless effort – Russia certainly deploys all the tools that they've got against the United States to really affect the discourse in this country. And, you know, I just have to ask you to go back to 2016 for a second. There were a number of things that I can highlight that the Russians did, but the thing that sticks out most in my mind is that they ran a rally for Black Lives Matter and white supremacists on the same day, same time, at the same location. The only thing the public saw was the news coverage of this confrontation between two groups. Russia didn't create the gap between Black Lives Matter and white supremacists. They took the existing structure in the United States of differences that we had, and they just highlighted them. So they didn't make anything up. They used the differences we have societally in this country, and they magnified them to where the media saw this as a newsworthy story. And you've got to understand that it was not just Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google. It was the use of RT and Sputnik, German broadcast outlets, that reinforced this message that then made it legitimate for American broadcasters to carry the story in the same way.
That's North Carolina Senator Richard Burr speaking at Duke University. He's discussing Russia's threat to American society. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. State lawmakers are considering a new way to help school teachers pay for classroom supplies in North Carolina. State Senator Andy Wells recently unveiled the details.
North Carolina taxpayers are spending $6.5 billion on K-12 education. That's why we're number two in teacher compensation in the Southeast. Every year, part of that money, around $50 million, is sent to local school boards to pay for supplies for classrooms. But in the past, that $50 million hasn't gone straight to classroom teachers. Instead, the money was paid to local school boards, which turned out to be a mistake. Because all too often, local bureaucrats decided not to spend the money on school supplies. What did they spend it on? The answer to that question isn't simple. It varies from school district to school district. But the short answer is, bureaucrats used the money to pay for other things on their to-do list and left teachers paying for their own classroom supplies. When I learned that money appropriated to pay for school supplies wasn't being spent on school supplies, I asked, why don't we send the money straight to teachers? Under our Senate bill, every licensed teacher in North Carolina will receive $400 to pay for classroom supplies. And bureaucrats will no longer be able to take that money and spend it on something else.
The Senate proposal has won support from State Superintendent of Public Instruction Mark Johnson.
During my time teaching, I vividly remember not having enough copy paper. I was a high school teacher, and I relied heavily on the copy machine and the copy paper. I remember putting in the request time and time again with my school for copy paper, but never getting enough to fulfill the needs of my classroom. Instead, I relied on money from my own pocket, as well as the generosity of organizations such as Classroom Central and other organizations like Educator Warehouse, where donated supplies can be given to teachers. That is the story of almost 100,000 teachers across North Carolina. For high school teachers, it might be copy paper. For kindergarten teachers, it might be construction paper and glue sticks and markers. No matter the supplies, many teachers in our state must reach into their own pockets to acquire what their students need.
The state superintendent, Mark Johnson, says the Senate plan fits with the goal of giving more tools to classroom teachers.
Finding a way for teachers to have more direct control over funding for classroom supplies has been a top priority. We started that in earnest last year when we helped deliver $200 for every kindergarten through third grade teacher to buy reading supplies through the Read to Achieve program. But we knew we could do more. We knew we had to do more. The NC Classroom Supplies program will allow every teacher to have direct control of $400 for classroom supplies in their classroom. Each teacher will be able to determine how to best spend those $400 for their classroom's needs.
That's State Superintendent of Public Instruction Mark Johnson. He's explaining his support for a plan to give every North Carolina school teacher access to $400 for school supplies.
First, just as we are working so hard to personalize learning for our students, we must acknowledge that every teacher has different individual needs for their classrooms. Giving teachers the maximum control over classroom supply funds is the ultimate local control. Teachers can be nimble, and they can use these funds to buy what they need when they need it. If we truly want to treat teachers as professionals, if we truly want to put our money where our trust is, then let's show teachers we trust them to make the right decisions for their classrooms.
There's another good reason to support the plan.
As an elected leader, as a parent, as a child in our public school system, and as a taxpayer, this program will provide greater transparency into where classroom supply funding is going. A topic as important as classroom supplies deserves all the transparency we can offer. This program will allow educators and policymakers to get real-time insight on the purchasing habits of teachers to know what the supply needs are across all of North Carolina. That insight will help policymakers at all levels work with educators to make sure we are getting the supply funding we need for our classrooms.
Johnson explains how technology makes the new program possible.
This is an app called Class Wallet. And Class Wallet will be an app that every teacher will be able to have access to. And if a teacher goes shopping at a store such as a Target, a Walmart, an Office Max, a Staples, or even some local stores that will be able to put, some North Carolina stores will be able to put on that list, they will be able to print out the receipt for what they purchase and take a picture of the receipt using this app. And then, much like a rewards program for a fast food restaurant, you will be able to have all the SKUs, making sure it's classroom supplies, validated, and the reimbursement will come to the teacher.
The State House's chief budget writer likes the idea. Republican Representative Jason Sain explains how information tied to the new classroom supply plan could help state budget writers.
Using the analytics that we'll receive from this app will help us in future years know, you know, what kind of supplies are needed, where should the money go, what is happening in the classroom. I know as a parent, we assist our classroom, our child's classroom, with supplies, our teachers, making sure that they have what they need. But at the same time, it gives teachers a tool to know, you know, they've got a lot to do, as we all know in a classroom. So it's a tool for the teacher as well to know where did they spend money? Where is it that they're looking and to supply their classroom year in and year out? So I think it gives everyone involved better analytics, better data, so that they can better understand what's happening in the classroom.
The bill's main sponsor, Senator Andy Wells, likes the idea of having more information about classroom supply needs.
That's been part of the frustration. We hear about classroom supplies, but we don't know exactly where they're needed, in what grades. We had that conversation early on. What classroom teachers need more, what need less, where do we start? We have no data, from historical data, to tell us exactly where this need is. This tool will allow us to identify exactly where those needs are and exactly where to target funds and exactly which teachers need them the most.
The state superintendent, Mark Johnson, expects a few startup hiccups. He says the program still makes sense.
This is a major undertaking. No state the size of North Carolina has tried to do something like this. But we know this is important for teachers. We know that the communities, the teachers, they have been asking for something like this for years. And it is time for us to be bold in our actions for supporting teachers in the classroom. That's exactly what we're doing. So I fully expect that when this rolls out at the start of the school year, we will run across issues. But a few issues are absolutely worth the benefit that this will bring for teachers across the state.
You've been listening to highlights of a news conference promoting a new classroom supply program for North Carolina. It will give every public school teacher in the state access to $400 for supplies. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Earlier this year, Governor Roy Cooper proposed his budget plan for the new fiscal year, and now state budget writers are knee-deep in crafting their version of the operating budget. With the North Carolina House having now unveiled its plan, we're getting a sense of the spending priorities and what may end up taking effect on July 1st. Joe Coletti is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He has analyzed both the governor's proposal and the House proposal. He joins us now to let us know what is in both of those documents. Joe, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about Governor Cooper's proposal first. Give us a kind of an overview of his spending, his taxing, and his priorities.
Yeah, the governor surprisingly did not increase income taxes or repeal any of the existing tax breaks that are in there. Although he does have a tax increase, he just doesn't call it that, with his Medicaid expansion. And so that's his top priority, remains his top priority. And it would require $200 million of state money the first year, $400 million the second year. And overall, he was increasing spending by $1.3 billion compared to the current year. So one of the things that will, as we start comparing the two budgets though, is that the governor eliminates a state capital and infrastructure fund that the House has, and that is in law. And with that, there's some adjustments with how debt service gets calculated. And so when people look at the numbers, they might see, oh, the governor wants to spend $25.2 billion. But because of that funding difference, a comparable number is actually $24.5 billion, where the House is looking at $24 billion.
Okay.
So he's still looking to spend a lot more than they are, but to get that comparable number, his spending appropriations compared to the House would be 24.5. And now we can talk about the House.
Because the governor can't just propose and say, voila, I deem this to be. He's got to work with state lawmakers on this. And so there's some wheeling and dealing that goes on. We have now seen the North Carolina House version of a proposed operating budget. So give us a sense of the House's spending and taxing and their priorities.
Yeah, so the House spends less than the governor, about $600 million less, which, and they even spend less than they said, than their agreement on spending that they had reached with the Senate and had announced earlier this year. So, overall, that's a relatively positive thing that they're not spending as much. It's still a little faster than I would feel comfortable with, but overall, it's a, and that still leaves the Senate some room to be able to come back and bring the spending even lower, and because they still then have to negotiate, because we know that they're not going to agree on every point.
Right. And you mentioned the Senate because they're the other player in this. So we are only partway through this whole process here of trying to put together this budget, even though the budget has to take effect on July 1st. So they've got another a little less than a couple of months here to get this all worked out. Joe, have you seen any overlapping priorities between Governor Cooper's proposal and the House proposal? Do they agree on anything?
They agree. They actually, 90% of the budget, because when we're talking about these changes, the House is increasing spending by $700 million. The governor increased it by $1.3 billion. And we're talking about budgets that are $24.5 billion. So there's a lot of agreement there. And even in the changes that they're looking at, they want to give higher pay to teachers especially and to principals. And so both proposals had a significant amount of new money for teacher and principal salaries and compensation overall. The House has a smaller increase for state employees. They both fund Raise the Age, which is the law that went into effect last year to bring 17-year-olds out of the adult criminal justice system. And so there's a good amount of spending to provide more district attorneys and more court staff and more housing for those teen offenders. And so there's a lot of agreement across the board on what the priorities are. The biggest difference again is the Medicaid expansion that the governor wants, claims is free, and that the House does not include, and that the Senate will not include either.
And he claims it's free because there's a lot of federal money that would come down to North Carolina. But North Carolina still would have a pretty heavy lift.
Yeah. And he claims it's free because that lift that the state has, it would be borne by hospitals with a provider tax. And that provider tax is an expansion of existing taxes on that side. So there's and they both keep the Medicaid transformation intact. And there's some new taxes that go along with that, because it's a new realm of business for these insurance companies to take on what the state had previously paid, all with tax dollars.
Let's talk a little bit more about your analysis of the House version of the budget. Are there any trends or any items in the budget that you think really either keep or put North Carolina on a positive track?
For the spending is still slightly less than inflation and population, which is the general yardstick that we do to make sure that spending remains constant, adjusted for inflation per person. And so that's a good thing. I still think that should be lower. They are starting to fund the capital from their state capital and infrastructure fund, and continue to set aside savings. And they should set aside more savings because we took out $750 million to deal with hurricanes last year. But still putting aside money in on that is always a positive thing. And continuing to reduce taxes and try to do it in a prudent way. And for the first 2 years, that is. And one of the interesting things in the House budget is an increase in spending for the university system so that they can utilize their buildings through the summer more. It brings about funds, more summer programs. There's going to be some offset with tuition. But we have these facilities at all the university campuses that sit idle for about 3 months a year. and they're looking for ways, how do we increase the utilization of these so that we're actually getting money out of our investments.
Yeah. What about trends that you are not so hot on, so to speak, any negative trends? Because I know you are someone who really thinks that fiscal stewardship is key to keeping North Carolina on track. And what are you seeing that maybe we should be watching really closely?
The second year of the budget, there are significant increases. So the salary increases that and compensation increases from the first year balloon a little bit in the second year. The Medicaid growth in the first year becomes significant in the second year. And then the tax reductions kick in actually the third year. So we don't see it in the budget document that's there, but that starts to kick in later on. And so those trends start to become worrisome, that are we going to continue to spend higher and higher while we continue to reduce revenues? And spending growth the second year is 4% higher than it is in the first year of the budget. And so that kind of trend is really concerning, especially because next year is the election year and they will likely want to add on top of that. And so that's where I start to see some concerns.
And to that point, Joe, the next stop for this will be the North Carolina Senate. They tend to be even more fiscally conservative than the House. So will it be the Senate coming up with something that maybe reins in some of those troublesome trends?
I expect and I hope that they do, yes.
And then after that, they got to sit down and finally agree on a document, and then there will be votes, and then the governor gets to weigh in.
And he'll veto, and then we'll be still talking in July.
Joe Coletti is Senior Fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Joe, thank you.
Thanks, Nana.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.